Welcome to another episode of the High Existence Podcast. John Brooks here. Today's interview is conducted by Eric. He speaks to Adam Strauss, and I'm going to pass over the mic in just a second for Eric to introduce the contents of this interview. But I just want to say one thing quickly. We are at the moment in a strange time. We're being bombarded by the news, by media, by kind of strange formulaic interviews and TV appearances and politicians speaking in this strange scripted way. This interview is not like that at all. It's very real, human, vulnerable, useful, funny, sad. And really, more than anything, you get a chance to just hang out with two wise human beings as they sort of discuss life and spirituality and psychedelics. It's very raw, and I think this is the kind of thing that we need right now. We need to connect back with human-to-human connection. So, Eric, please introduce today's episode.
Hey, everyone. This is Eric Brown, and today I'm here with Adam Strauss. I had the honor of meeting Adam in person last year and just immediately wanted to dive a little deeper with him. His story, his projects, and really just his philosophies and outlooks are fascinating, and I think this really comes across in our conversation today. Adam's an established comedian in the New York comedy scene, and he's really exploded into the psychedelic space recently with his release of The Mushroom Cure, a project looking at his personal explorations with using psilocybin to help treat and manage his OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. This is one of the more personal and vulnerable conversations I've had publicly, as we both really dive deep into our experiences with managing OCD, navigating mental illness and the psychedelic waters, and just the present and future of the burgeoning psychedelic movement at large. And so with all of that said, I really hope you enjoy this open and honest conversation with Adam.
Hey everyone, I'm here with Adam. And I had the pleasure of meeting Adam a few months ago at Mapping the Mind, a Toronto psychedelic science conference, where he was our MC and host for the day. And it was actually really nice because you can get lost in the seriousness and science of those events, and to bring some light and levity throughout it was a welcomed antidote, a welcomed medicine to the experience. Adam, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Eric.
I think the easiest place to start is, if someone asks you what you do or who you are, how do you respond to that?
Well, who I am is obviously one of the great existential mysteries for all of us. So I don't ever expect to have to be able to answer that question with any confidence. What I do is slightly easier to answer, though not entirely. So, I mean, I started off as a stand-up comic, and that's still, you know, I have a couple of shows tonight. That's still what I guess you could say I spend at least half, if not more than half of my time doing. And so most of that is, for lack of a better term, generic comedy, meaning I'm talking about, it's for generic comedy club audiences, people who may not have any particular psychedelic experience or knowledge. But then I had these particular experiences where I was, well, I'm sure we'll get more into this, but I was struggling with very debilitating and tractable OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, for many years. And I found a study where it looked like psilocybin containing mushrooms, or the study was psilocybin, the pure compound, but basically it looked like psychedelic mushrooms could potentially help OCD. So I tried to treat myself. And out of those experiences came a show called The Mushroom Cure, which is certainly not traditional stand-up. I perform that in theaters versus comedy clubs, which I think reflects the fact that it is more of a dramatic show, but it is also comedic as well. So I between doing solo monologues, I've done a few other monologues not directly related to psychedelics and stand-up. The way I usually describe it when people ask me is I say I talk alone on stage. That's sort of the blanket descriptor, doing stand-up and theater monologues, and then some related writing as well.
Yeah, and I'm glad we got to this because I wanted to bring it up. I was having a conversation with my friend about a week or two ago, and we were talking about just how to work through difficult experiences, particularly something like early trauma. And a common theme that comes up, and you know, this is also relevant to why I believe, and it seems to appear that the psychedelic experience can also help with this, is that if you can approach these difficult subjects or events or memories in a state of, in a more positive, open state, it's actually easier to work with them because you're a little more open, you're a little more trusting, you're not as frightened. And actually, comedy seems to be an amazing vehicle to do that as well. You know, a lot of comedians can bring up somewhat sensitive subjects in common culture, but in this vehicle of comedic jest and of openness, and it lets us look at things that we might turn away from. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, you kind of hit what I view as one of the main ways that comedy can serve. What I mean by that is, well, if I'll take this show, The Mushroom Cure, so it is a pretty dark and heavy story at times. The OCD was extremely severe, and my life was really dominated by it. And so I talk about that I don't just talk about it in the show. I really kind of depict it. I actually try to go back there as much as possible. And that's certainly not fun. It's not, I don't think it's enjoyable for someone to see that. It may be engaging. It may be, you know, it may be illuminating, but it's not going to be fun. So if I were to have, you know, 90 minutes of just that, people might walk out of the show being like, oh, wow, that was intense, or I learned something. But I want people to have not just this kind of, I want them to have a varied experience because, well, ultimately that's what life is. You know, things are never all dark or all light. And I think where comedy can come in, can be very helpful is there's an opening that comes when you laugh. I mean, laughter is a mysterious thing. We really don't understand laughter. There's various evolutionary biology theories that posit it has to do with social cohesion and group bonding. And I'm sure there's something to that, but fundamentally it's this, there's really nothing quite like laughter. It's this involuntary, pleasurable, physiological response. And there's all these corollary interesting questions, you know, why can't you tickle yourself? So I don't want to get too far afield. But laughter is, to me, it's profound and I would say mystical because it is a opening. It is a letting go. And so I look at laughter as sort of one of the highest purposes of laughter can be when someone is laughing, they're unguarded and they're open. So I like to look at it as if I can get people to laugh, then they're in an open state and then I can kind of, you know, cram some truth down there quickly before they realize what's happening. And then it's also the whole spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. So if you're talking about, like you said, you know, stuff that may be painful, leavening it with some laughter makes it a lot more palatable for everyone. So yeah, I like to see laughter as something that, can open people up to things that otherwise they might not be fully open to.
Yeah, it seems to help us get over this initial, like, knee-jerk reactive closing, where right when you hear something difficult, you just pull away. But because you're in that context and you know, or particularly if you go to a comedy show, you have the expectation that something light and funny will come of this, so you can lean in a little easier. And again, with things that can be sensitive topics, this is incredibly useful. And the other angle of this, and it really actually prompted me asking you to come do this conversation, is, you know, we have all these scientific studies coming out, a lot of excitement in that space. There's more articles and things being published online about this. But there's still this wall of opaqueness that comes from that. You lose the humanness. Like these are people's lives. They have stories and relationships. And when we can tie it back to, you know, this was someone's experience and they were suffering and there might actually be a solution here. I think at present we might underestimate a bit how powerful and how useful that tool is as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll credit, Rick Doblin, so MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, sponsors the Mushroom Cure. And Rick Doblin, the founder, his take on it was, you know, of course, scientific data is crucial for changing, changing the legal status and opening doors in the medical context. But what he said is, data doesn't change minds. What changes people's minds is ultimately stories. So I view part of not just my story, but everyone has stories here, as it can be a vehicle for, it's going to be a lot more powerful. You can read the data, and the data is certainly coming out right now in this current wave of studies is remarkable and, generally tremendously positive. But that's probably going to have less impact than a close friend of yours telling you how, MDMA helped his PTSD, or how he was able to finally quit smoking thanks to mushrooms. That's going to have a more sort of visceral emotional impact. And really, that's what I think. I don't want to get too far afield, but I feel like certainly it seems like the tide is on our side right now of the psychedelic movement, for lack of a better term. But I think it's naive to assume that that's going to continue to be the case, that there's not going to be significant pushback. So I look at it as we have a window of opportunity after this research being completely shut down for decades. There's now this window where I think it's incumbent upon us to push not just the research as far as we can, as quickly as we can, of course, in a responsible way, but also try to push public opinion in that direction, because there will be pushback at some point in time, inevitably. I think there's a lot of people who, and established interests, who have a lot to lose as psychedelics become more of an accepted mainstream, not just treatment, but avenue for self-exploration and societal change. Certainly pharmaceutical companies might be top of that list. And the pharmaceutical industry in the United States spends more money on lobbying politicians than any other industry, including oil and gas extraction. But then I think the changes ultimately are going to be further reaching than just that. I mean, I think you will see, if there is a wider spread use of psychedelics, particularly in a more intentional fashion, you're going to see ramifications in our political system, in our criminal justice system, in society at large. And certainly it stands to reason that people who have a lot of power right now stand to lose something. So I kind of look at it like right now, the opposing team isn't even on the field. You know, we're kind of bringing the ball down. They don't even know there's a game on right now, but that's going to change at some point. So we want the ball as far down the field as we can when that changes. And I think personal stories are a really, really powerful way to do that.
That was beautifully said. And something that came up in that discussion was, it's also useful to have this, almost this rebranding or this updated image taking place where, you know, there are just people no different than you or I who, you know, hold jobs, who go about their days, who try to provide for their family. And sure, maybe there's an obstacle, or, you know, an area that I'm particularly excited about is just what these experiences can do for quote unquote healthy normals, right? People who are just doing fine and could continue their own process and their own growth. Because there is a lot of this friction that comes in because, you know, the dominant like archetype or image that people associate this space with is the flower crown hippies, drop out of society, do nothing with yourself. And it doesn't have to be that way, right? There are a lot of like really capable, driven people who have been, because of that stigma, somewhat hesitant to come out of the woodwork or speak publicly about this. But the more we can actually share these just rationed, reasonable stories, I think the more, again, it helps us kick that ball further down the field, because it's not some airy-fairy woo-woo space. It's just, hey, you know, I had some struggle. I worked through it. Or I just want to be better for myself, my family, and the world. And this is a vehicle to do that. And so that, I think that rebranding can also help help kick that ball a little bit down the field.
Absolutely. And I think the other part of that is, you know, the first thing that you said in that little example is I had some struggles, and that independent of people being open about psychedelic use, we just don't get enough of that. We just don't get enough of people talking openly about their struggles. And I think social media there, it can be a bit of a double-edged sword, but largely I think it's been a negative thing because our natural tendency, of course, is to compare ourselves to others. And typically on social media, people choose to highlight the best parts of their lives. And it's very easy to look, you know, to go to an Instagram feed or Facebook and be like, wow, everyone else is killing it. Meanwhile, I could barely get out of the fetal position today. And I say a double-edged sword because I think we are starting to see some, a little bit more honest sharing on social media, but still, by and large, people post their victories there. So the very fact of someone coming out and saying, yeah, I really struggled with depression, or I just couldn't quit drinking, or, you know, I had a sexual addiction, whatever the case is, and psychedelics helped, just the first part alone, I think, is doing a service, saying, yeah, I was dealing with something that I really felt hopeless about because, I mean, if you're human, you're going to have moments, and probably more than just moments, days, weeks, months, years maybe, of real hopelessness. And not sharing that with each other, I think we do one another a disservice because it makes us feel more isolated. And I think we do ourselves a disservice because if we don't share that, really what we're telling ourselves at some level is, oh, there's something wrong. I want to conceal this from people. I should have some shame around this. And with the mushroom cure, for me, the most remarkable thing I've done the show hundreds of times now, but initially, the big sort of coming out of the closet for me wasn't coming out about psychedelics, though, I mean, I first did the show in 2012, and it was a very different climate for psychedelics. I certainly did have some fear and trepidation around that, but the bigger thing was coming out about how debilitated I'd been in the past from OCD for so long. And I think that's what a lot of people respond to in the show is not just the psychedelic aspect, but seeing someone be very opening about their suffering and their struggles.
Yeah, and really now we're getting into the crux of it because I fully agree. Like it's really just a vehicle to connect us with our humanity again, recognizing that, no, I can be soft and squishy too. I don't have to always just hold up the shield. Because in holding that, in being strong, or in kind of holding yourself back, you hold back all of the good as well. You don't just get to pick and choose. If you close yourself off from the bad, you close it off from the good. And we see that taking hold now when a lot of people feel numb and disconnected from their emotions. And it's like, guys, we're all right here. We're all going through the same thing.
Yeah, there's a tendency to try to disown those parts of ourselves. And I think it's reinforced from our early, you know, upbringings for most people. There's a great Emerson quote, I think it's Self-Reliance, which is one of my favorite Emerson essays, but he's talking about how at an early age, you know, maybe he's a teenager, and he asked some pastor, religious leader, he said, what need do I have, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, what need do I have of the church and its teachings if I live wholly from within? You know, which I interpret as if I live wholly authentically, why do I even need the church? And this religious person said, well, how do you know that these impulses are from above and not from below? Meaning, how do you know they come from, you know, God essentially and not from the devil? And Emerson's reply, which I love, he said, well, they seem good to me, but if they come from the devil, then I'll be the devil's child. You know, if ultimately we can only be, it seems to me that at some level, we certainly have free will and we can choose our actions. But these deep impulses, I don't think we can choose those. And I think living authentically within those is generally the way to serve best, to serve others best, and to live up to what we can ultimately be. So I'm not saying, you know, given to your, if your impulse is to murder people, probably, you know, that, but I don't know. Maybe I have a naive view there. I think that I believe that people are inherently good and want to do good. And therefore, I believe that getting in touch with the darkness, which I don't think is for most people, I want to kill people. It's more like there are these parts of myself that I have shame around, or there are these desires that I feel are wrong. Getting in touch with them allows us to work with them and own them and not be subconsciously controlled by them. And that's where I think psychedelics can be, one of the ways psychedelics can be really indispensable.
Well said. Yeah, you get into this like should spiral, just oh, I shouldn't feel this way, or I should be doing this, and it's like who told you that it needed to be this way? Why are you telling yourself this? And you know, this was actually one of the things, this was actually the main thing that really prompted me to speak to you at the conference and bring up this conversation, because I had actually not been exposed to you and your work before the conference, but you were the first person. I told you at the conference that I actually have a very similar story. I was quite debilitated going through school, and we can get into the differences kind of what we both went through. But like, yeah, I would like start missing class because I was like cleaning my room. Or like, you know, how can I focus on a lecture if my laundry isn't done yet, right? And the priorities just became completely imbalanced, and it was very difficult. And then, you know, you go through the whole gamut. You go through talk therapy, you go through cycles of medication, you go through combinations of the two, and you might make some progress, you might not. And then eventually you get to the point where you take it into your own hands, and yeah, there was quite a lot of overlap there, but it ties into what you said earlier. There was this immediate weight that like came off of me in hearing you even discuss that in the opening remarks that you made. I was like, holy crap, this wasn't just some weird thing that was all mine to carry and no one else knew. It was just like this, oh my God, like there's a shared humanity that came up again. And so I would like to dig into kind of your history and your experience with this. I guess the easiest, or the place I would like to start, is a two-part question. One is, did you end up receiving like a clinical diagnosis?
Yes. And I'm sorry, go on. You said two-part, and I'm already jumping in. Please continue.
Beautiful. And so it's good that, or it's helpful that you said yes, because What was your experience like before you had a label to kind of bucket all of this under? Like, what, as these kind of, and maybe you can explain like some of your tics and habits and manifestations of it, but like, what were you thinking about yourself as this stuff was coming up?
Yeah, it's a good question. So how much do I want to get into? I'm willing to share everything, but I guess, Jermaine, for your question. So my OCD did, and to the extent it still does, and it still does sometimes, it manifests around decision-making. So you can look at it as the, you know, all OCD, there's some sort of unwanted thought. So in your case, the thought might be, or someone with, you know, contamination fear, it might be, I'm dirty, I'm contaminated. Someone else, their thought might be, did I leave the stove on? Someone else who has taboo thoughts, which is an increasingly common, if you talk to clinicians, seems form of OCD, their thought might be, am I attracted to small children? So there's some thought, and the thought is threatening in some way. There is an emotional reaction to that thought, an anxiety reaction. And by the way, I'd say, right that up to that point, it's all pretty normal. I think everyone gets weird thoughts some of the time. And for most people, for whatever reason, they're able to just kind of let those thoughts go. But what really differentiates OCD is you develop some sort of ritualized behavior to try to neutralize that thought. There is a form of OCD called pure O, and I'll get to that in a moment, where ostensibly there's no ritual, but I would argue that in the cases of pure O, there is. It's just more of an internal ritual. So anyway, in my case, the thought would be, the threatening thought would be, am I making a mistake? Or maybe it's, you know, I am making a mistake, but some fear that I was making the wrong decision. And then to try to get rid of that anxiety, I would reverse my decision. So an example I talk about in the mushroom cure is I'd start walking down the street, and then I would think, well, wait, I should walk down the other side of the street because there's more sunshine on the other side of the street. And so I'd cross over. And then I'd be walking on that side of the street, and I'd think, well, wait a second, I'm not wearing sunscreen. I should cross back to the side that's shady. And I'd cross back. And then I'd think, well, wait, but I need sunshine because I need vitamin D. And I could literally just zigzag back and forth walking down the street. So a small example, but, you know, it's often said that life is about decisions. But I'd go a step further and say life isn't just about decisions. Life is decisions. I think that, you know, scientists debate what is the definition of life. It actually gets surprisingly murky. Is a virus alive? Questions like that. And I've never heard anyone say this, but I think a good definition of life could be an organism or an entity, a form that adapts to its environment that by making decisions. You know, you could look at a plant and say, well, yeah, it's deciding. I mean, putting aside the question of consciousness, it's deciding to go around that rock underground to send its root structure in this direction and send its leaves this direction. So getting a little philosophical here, but certainly as a conscious human, our existence, you can really look at it as moving from one decision to another. Many of those decisions, we don't think about decisions. We might not think of it as a decision to go to work if we have a 9-to-5 job. We might not think of it as a decision to eat or drink water, but those are decisions. And in my case, all of these decisions became conscious and became overwhelming. I would just get trapped. So it became very debilitating. I mean, every decision, what to do, where to go, what to eat, who to see, every decision just, I would start ping-ponging back and forth and get totally trapped. And to answer your question, I didn't initially know what was going on. It started very suddenly. It started after, I guess you could view it as a trauma. I had a particularly significant romantic relationship end. I had my heart broken, and I started engaging in this behavior. And I look at it as, really in my case, I had my heart broken. What I mean by that, I mean there was a deep emotional wound. But I didn't know how to feel that wound. I'd seen therapists before, actually from a fairly early age, I'd seen therapists because even though I didn't have OCD, I did have a lot of anxiety and perfectionism and obsessiveness. I could get fixated on ideas. So I'd seen a lot of therapists, and some of them were quite gifted, but no one ever said to me, well, what are you feeling in your body right now? It was more like talking about, well, why are you having these thoughts? What can you do about these thoughts, these obsessive thoughts, these perfectionistic thoughts? And so when this relationship ended, it was for me the most natural thing in the world. Rather than just feeling that loss in my body, in my heart, and I use heart in a non-metaphorical sense there. I feel loss around the center of my chest. Other people may feel it in other places, but that seems to be where I personally feel most emotion. So there's this deep feeling of loss there. And I think if I'd been willing and able to just really experience it, it would have passed eventually, but I wasn't. Instead, I went even further into my head, and it was kind of like, well, I'm feeling something is wrong. I didn't know exactly what was wrong, but I knew there was a very wrong feeling. So, okay, if I can just make the right decisions in every moment, then I'll have a perfect life. It was almost this childish, magical thinking, but it was very logical to me at the time. And I got trapped in that. And the thing about OCD is it's a vicious cycle. The more you engage in the behavior, you may get a little bit of relief. So in my case, if I'm obsessing about a decision, let's say I decide to walk down this side of the street, the sunny side, but now I start feeling anxiety because I probably should be on the other side of the street. So I cross over to the shady side, and when I cross over, I'll often feel, I mean, I don't have this anymore, but I would feel a little bit of relief. Okay, good, good. Now I'm making the right decision. And that's reinforcing. And that relief might last for 20 seconds. And then I'm thinking, well, wait, no. I need sunshine. I should cross back. And I'll feel anxious, and then I cross back, and I get more relief. So what happens is the more you engage in OCD behavior, getting these little momentary hits of relief, not always, but some of the time. But then meanwhile, you know, my whole life was falling apart because you can't exist if you're not willing to make decisions and move on. And that created even more anxiety. And the more anxious I got, the more I'd engage in this ritualized, obsessive decision-making behavior. And the more I engaged in that behavior, the more anxious I got. And it just, you know, became completely, started to completely dominate. And so I wasn't quite sure what was going on, and it took about a year before I finally had a therapist who actually said, you know, this isn't like the traditional manifestation of OCD, but this is in a sense, it's classic OCD because it fits the pattern.
Yeah, and Wow, there was a lot there. Maybe this is just an N of two, but I certainly share in hindsight this notion that there was maybe a single or a few events where you felt like you weren't in control, like you weren't able to guide your life, and then as a counterbalance to that, it just became, I'm going to control everything. Everything that I can like touch and have access to, like it's mine. Like I am going to, everything is going to be in its right place. I'm going to figure out the best action to take. And to your point, there seems to be this loss of priority in decisions where every decision just becomes the most important thing, whether it's like continuing to go to work or like ironing your shirts. Like they're just both the exact same importance, like life or death level. And you know, when everything's in your room around you and it's all important, it just consumes your time and your mental space. That's why you know, a word that comes up is often something like debilitating, because you're running in circles. You're just, everything is just constantly being focused on.
Yeah, no, it was exactly my experience. You put it perfectly. Yeah, things are out of control, so you're going to hyper control, and then this total loss of prioritization is a perfect way to put it, where it's like, I have to get everything right. And I kind of sometimes look at the OCD as it's trying to help. You know, on the surface, the idea of making the best decisions makes perfect sense. It's just kind of like, it's kind of like a little kid who doesn't realize, I don't know if this is a perfect metaphor, but like doesn't realize he can't have, you know, can't have chocolate for every meal. It doesn't realize that actually spending 2 hours trying to decide, you know, trying to decide what to eat for lunch is not a good strategy overall. It just can look at this micro level of, oh, there's a decision here. We have to make the best possible decision. And of course, the other problem with this particular form of OCD is the more you obsess about something, the less certain you are. Because ultimately, we can never be certain about any decision. That is, to me, sort of the cosmic joke is, I believe we have free will. We can choose essentially anything we want, you know, given our life circumstances. But we never know what the result of those choices will be. And often the result of those choices are, you know, wildly unpredictable. So, I mean, I'm looking out my window right now at the spire of the One World Trade Center. You know, there were people who made a trivial choice to stop for a morning coffee on the morning of September 11th, 2001, and are alive because of it. And there's other people who decided to go to have breakfast at Windows of the World and didn't make it out. So that's an extreme example. And that obviously is not true of most decisions, but I think the fact that it can be true of any decision can be unnerving and can drive us to really try to get it right, but ultimately we can't get it right. But better put, we can't know if we're getting it right.
Yeah, it's funny. We always. A lot of this space talks about the importance of being present in your experience and actually staying at the center and experiencing the things happening around you. But with this, there seems to be like a switch that's flipped where you actually lose perspective on the future. And you're solely wrapped up in this, like everything is happening right now. But it's like, is that going to be good for like 2 hours or 2 days or 2 weeks from now? Because yeah, I can figure out how to make a sandwich for lunch for like 4 days. That's probably not the best move, but like I can't decouple myself from like literally right now, and everything is happening and it's all super important. And so then this doctor brings it up and he says, cool, classic symptoms. Finally there's a bucket or a label or a thing to actually interact and engage with. What was that like? Like, was there a switch in now having a concrete label to work with? And then what work was done after actually getting the label or the diagnosis?
Yeah, well, initially I had some resistance to that diagnosis because, you know, I was like, well, I don't wash my hands constantly. I don't have these sort of stereotypical symptoms. But I did gradually start to accept it. And I was already on medication. I'd been on SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, you know, which are, they're often called antidepressants, but they're really these kind of, well, the truth is we don't exactly know what they do. And for most people, they don't do much, but they're also the first line of medication for OCD. And so I was already on those, even though I hadn't been diagnosed with OCD because I had, you know, this high anxiety and perfectionism. So I was already on the medication. We upped the dose a little bit. The tricky thing, you know, with OCD, a lot of the best evidence for treatment outside of psychedelics is for like cognitive behavioral therapy. But it was difficult to apply in my case. If you're afraid of, you know, if you have hand washing, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, might entail, all right, you know, you're going to touch a doorknob in a public restroom and you're not going to wash your hands for 10 minutes. Then you're not going to wash your hands for 20 minutes. Then you're not going to wash your hands. And you might eventually work up to literally licking the floor of a public restroom, like something even a normal person wouldn't do, to really kind of, it's called flooding or exposure response prevention. And that can be quite effective. It's not always, but it can be. But in my case, it was difficult to devise these sort of exposures around decision making. So I was working with a gifted therapist, but it wasn't particularly helpful. So I had a label, and it helped a little bit to depersonalize it, to feel like, okay, it's not this totally unique, insane thing that only I have. But it still seemed like a pretty totally unique, insane thing. And unfortunately, in my case, traditional therapy, I won't say it was useless, but it had, you know, maybe it was 10 or 15% helpful. And so that was the state I was in when I finally found this study showing that psychedelics might be helpful.
Yeah, it's always, it's back to the double-edged sword. I find the label, it can be both helpful because it's like, I have this other that I can interact with, that I can kind of dance with, and it makes more sense. But I also, at least personally, I found myself immediately like painting my entire history with that brush now. Like, oh yeah, okay, so I guess that thing I did when I was 16 was a manifestation of this, and oh, all those things I did when I was growing up, and like it just became my whole experience was like filtered through this thing as well, because I was like, oh shit, this is a part of me, and I guess everything is a representation of it. So there's two sides to that, and we are at the beautiful point of kind of the citizen science here. But right before we dive in, could you speak to what you view as the difference between just being like a driven type A person who cares a lot and is serious about decisions, and then the kind of up-leveling to something like, how would that become obsessive? How would that become compulsive? Like, what is the distinction between just being a person that cares a lot and makes serious decisions and wants high performance, and then up-leveling to something that could be diagnosed?
For me, I look at it as the question of functioning. How much is your functioning impaired? Because you bring up a great point, which is this stuff doesn't exist as like totally discrete categories. You know, there is a, I think particularly with OCD type behavior, and certainly, well, let's take obsessiveness as kind of a character trait. It exists in a continuum, no question. And absolutely, it can be adaptive, certainly. As you were saying, someone who is very driven and kind of deliberates about decisions, where does that cross over? And so, yeah, there's not an absolute binary sort of switching point. But to me, I look at it as, because I talk to a lot of people, you know, as particularly people who see the show will be like, wow, you know, I relate to that, but I don't think I have OCD. And the question I'll always ask them is, well, how much does it impair your functioning? So it's kind of a circular definition in a way, because you're saying, well, if it impairs you, it's, you know, it's quote unquote mental illness. If it doesn't, it's not. But really what I try to get at with that question is the idea of, well, if it doesn't really impair you, if it doesn't cause significant suffering or, you know, just lack of ability to live and function in the world, then I wouldn't worry about it, you know, because it certainly can be adaptive. And in my case, I think I was an example, though, of, by the same token, I'd say be vigilant, because my case was I was someone who probably fell into the former category, someone who was driven, who was perfectionistic. It caused problems sometimes, but it also, there were benefits. And then it crossed over very quickly once I had this loss or this trauma into a more kind of purely pathological form.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, because I brought that up. I just didn't want people sitting at home kind of running through their heads like, oh, you know, I make a lot of decisions, and then go down that whole rabbit hole. So we're now at the place where you're working with something, you're working with a team, you have both pharmaceutical medication, talk therapy. They seem to be managing symptoms, more or less, like
not even not really for me, honestly. Some people get that. I wouldn't say there was really no point of stability that was reached. There was some, the medication for me, which I was already on, so it's hard to, but you know, I was up the dose, maybe it lowered baseline anxiety a little bit, but it really didn't help the OCD, and the therapy didn't really help either. I'd say honestly a lot of the value was probably having just support, having a therapist who I could talk to about this. And like you said, being able to have this thing that I could identify as an other, get a little bit of separation, that was helpful. But there wasn't, despite having, you know, I'm in New York, I was in New York then, there were great therapists, I had a really good psychopharmacologist, but it helped a little bit, but not much.
Yeah, I'm glad we got to this space. I actually wrote an article for High Existence about a year and a half ago called "The Dose Will See You Now," and it's an introduction to psychedelic therapy. And though I don't think you would have gotten the exact this been given this terminology, but we're essentially at this point of like treatment resistance, where for mental illness we have two common approaches, right? We have pharmaceutical medication, we have some form of psychotherapy. Often a combination of the two working in tandem. That is like our platter that we can provide to people. And, you know, some may react well, right? Some may actually resolve cases with that. Often I think the majority is more of a management, like symptom management, rather than addressing root causes. But increasingly now, there's a whole group of people who just don't respond to either of those. And now they're cast out into this no man's land of like, you know, well, sorry, like we can try to up the dose. And it's like, we have these groups of people, and this applies to OCD, major depression, extreme anxiety, the whole classes of people who are just, I don't want to say forgotten about, but like, you kind of just have to shrug and be like, well, we don't really have an option. And this circles back to the point of like, well, maybe we actually do, right? And there's a growing body of science that seems to suggest that, you know, the intentional and structured and reasonable use of the psychedelic experience may actually be a viable avenue or vehicle to actually continue the growth and working with this. So can you speak to just some of your story with all of this?
Yeah. So, you know, there wasn't much symptom relief. Actually, not only was there not much symptom relief, things were getting worse, which is often the case with OCD. You know, depression, it's interesting because depression, you do get cases of spontaneous remission. There are people who are depressed and then kind of pull out of it and they're more or less fine. OCD, it doesn't, I've in my entire life, I've only met one person with OCD. Childhood OCD, sometimes that happens. It seems like sometimes kids have OCD and they outgrow it. But in terms of adult OCD, I've only ever met one person who seemed to pull out of it. And they were a pretty extraordinary person in a lot of ways. So often what happens, unfortunately, is the opposite, which is, you know, we were talking about this vicious cycle. The more you kind of get trapped in OCD, the more anxious you are, the more you do OCD behavior, the more you do that behavior, the more trapped you get. And that was my case. So things were getting worse and worse. And I, I was, well, I guess you could say obsessively researching different treatments. And I found at that time it was the only study, and in fact, it's still the only study that's been completed of any psychedelic for OCD. It was a small study out of the University of Arizona. And it wasn't a long-term study, but the results, it was only 9 subjects, but it looked like everyone in the study had some positive response to psilocybin. And anecdotally, one, I say anecdotally, so it was really a study of safety and kind of basic efficacy. But one of the subjects in the study, the researchers followed up with him, or he followed up with them, and it seemed like 6 months later, it seemed like he was still pretty much symptom free. So the researchers didn't use the word cure in the study, but I read that and I was like, well, it looks like this guy was cured with psilocybin. I had very limited experience with psychedelics at that point, but I had that desperation. So I decided, all right, I got to try this. I've tried everything else. Because I should say this too. I tried, it wasn't just medication and psychotherapy. I had done meditation, yoga, homeopathy, acupuncture, herbs, hypnotism. Like I tried everything. I tried everything because I was that desperate. So, and that's sort of the jumping off point for the show, The Mushroom Cure, is when I read that study. And I won't go through all the events I recount there, but yeah, ultimately, psychedelics proved to be very helpful for me. They were not and have not been an absolute cure. I call the show The Mushroom Cure because it's the story of my quest for this ultimate cure, but I didn't get that ultimate cure. I still identify myself. I mean, I have problems with labels, they're limiting, but OCD, it does seem like the label is somewhat apt. What I mean by that is, I don't mean the actual words obsessive compulsive disorder, but it does seem like there's this cluster of behaviors and thinking pattern that hangs together in a variety of manifestations in different people. And I identify as having that. And so I use the phrase OCD because that's the commonly accepted phrase. So it is much better now. It's much better in a few dimensions. I have what I would call episodes much less frequently. When I have them, it doesn't get nearly as bad. It doesn't last nearly as long. But I still do have them, albeit, pretty occasionally now. And I also have, I'm still obsessive. Let me put it that way. I can still get fixated on things for better and for worse, because there are, in certain contexts, obsessiveness is very useful. I look at it as like it may not be worth spending 2 hours deciding exactly how to make a sandwich, but it probably is worthwhile spending 2 hours how to structure a joke or how to word a punchline. And honestly, that's one thing that's helped me is having these productive channels for my obsessiveness. But psychedelics were absolutely instrumental in the recovery that I've had. And we can get more into exactly how they worked and all of that. But yeah, it's been an important part. And I'll say this, it continues to be an important part. I'm drinking ayahuasca tomorrow night. So it's something that I continue to avail myself of. It'll be my first ayahuasca experience since February. And I guess my first probably high dose psychedelic experience since then. So yeah, and I'm not doing it tomorrow night specifically for OCD. I find a variety of benefits. But yeah, I it certainly is an important part, not the only thing I do, but an important part of my I would say recovery from OCD.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff here, and I do want to dive into some of the other experiences you've had. I didn't realize there were others, but I was watching your discussion with Aubrey Marcus the other day, looking into this, and yeah, we definitely have some stuff to talk about there as well. You did highlight a very important point, one I think is sorely underrepresented right now, which is these things are not a panacea. They are not a magic experience that suddenly you are completely whole and complete, right? There is, like everything, it's a spectrum. It does seem that it can be useful, it can be an ally in the process, but by no means is it just this, like, pay the cost of admission and everything is beautiful again. So I'm really glad that you were able to bring that up. I would actually like to dig into just, so you indicated that things are, seems like a little more manageable, a little less severe when they do come. Were there particular, I just like, if there was anything that actually caused that, like what, was there anything in the experiences that you could correlate with leading to the lessening of those experiences?
Yeah, so again, the show is called The Mushroom Cure because there was that study with mushrooms that I first read, and that was kind of what I was questing for. But I did have the period I recount in the show, which was really a couple of years of pretty heavy psychedelic use, and I'll say not very intelligent psychedelic use. I was pretty hell-bent, so I was doing a lot of different psychedelics at high doses in often not ideal scenarios. You know, people ask for advice on treating OCD or other mental health issues with psychedelics, but often they'll say, well, what did you do? And I'll say, well, what I did is not what I'd advise anyone else to do. I think in a lot of ways I kind of got recovery in spite of being an idiot. I'll be kinder to myself. I was desperate. There wasn't nearly as much information out there then when I was having these experiences. But what I feel like was, so that's all by way of saying, you know, I wasn't a good controlled experimental subject. But where I have personally found psychedelics to be helpful is, so if you look at OCD, but I think this applies to really probably any quote unquote mental illness. I think in all cases, there's an avoidance component. You're trying to avoid something, some feared outcome. And so depression, you can look at as an avoidance where, all right, I'm just not going to get out of bed. You know, it's kind of this retreat. OCD is sort of the opposite. It's like, well, I'm going to do everything I possibly can. I've spoken to clinicians who treat schizophrenia, and even with those, you know, quote unquote psychotic disorders, there's an avoidance component. So to focus on OCD, though, because that's what I know firsthand, you know, we talked earlier, there's an unwanted thought and there's an unwanted physical sensation, some sort of anxiety, some sort of fear. So all of the treatment, cognitive behavioral treatment around OCD, it all centers around not trying to get rid of those unwanted thoughts and sensations, but allowing them to be there. Because the problem with OCD is that you try to get rid of them with some sort of ritualized behavior, or in the case of what's called pure obsession without compulsions, you're essentially engaging in these internal rituals, these particular thought patterns to try to get rid of a thought that you don't want and an anxiety. And that, as we've discussed, actually makes it worse. So it sets off this whole cycle. So I understood from the therapist I was working with that if I could just allow this thought that I'm making a mistake to be there and allow the anxiety to be there, I might not feel great, but I would be freed from engaging in this entire cycle. I would get some measure of freedom, and then hopefully over time the obsessions themselves would quiet down. The tricky thing, though, about acceptance, or we can use the word surrender, is, so I knew if I could accept and surrender to these thoughts, I would get freedom. But knowing this and appreciating it intellectually isn't the same as actually doing it. Surrender is it's a mysterious thing. It's kind of a mystical thing. It's really like, for me, surrender or acceptance, it's less of a mental thing and more of a physical thing. It's almost this allowing in your body. And you could go a step further and say it's maybe a spiritual thing. It's this leap of faith. So even though I understood that surrender would be a key to freedom, I wasn't able or willing, it's hard to say which, to actually do it. It was only with psychedelics that I had the visceral experience of actually surrendering. And I wish I could describe it in more detail, and I can to some extent, but ultimately it's an experience beyond words. But it's this experience for me of, I had, the first psychedelic I actually experienced it on was not mushrooms, but with LSD. And I was having certain thoughts that I found threatening, and I was trying to fight them off. But I was exhausted. I've been tripping for a while. And finally, I just said, okay, you know what? Come on in. Do your worst. And when I did that, it felt like, the metaphor I would use is it felt like, and the metaphor I kind of experienced at the time is it felt like you're standing on the edge of a 1,000-foot-high cliff. And it's like stepping off the edge of the cliff and you expect to plummet 1,000 feet to your death. But as soon as I stepped off, as soon as I surrendered and let go, it was like I fell 6 inches and there was a ledge below my feet. So I'm speaking in abstract terms. And again, that's sort of necessary when you're talking about this stuff. But putting aside the abstraction in more concrete terms, by allowing the stuff that I didn't want to experience, by actually experiencing it, it started to lose its power over me. And once I had that experience while tripping, so I wasn't able to do that until I was tripping, and I had that experience repeatedly while tripping on a variety of psychedelics. And often what would happen is coming out of the experience, I would have some freedom from the OCD, but then the OCD would come back. And then I had a few particularly powerful trips where the effects seemed to be longer lived, but really a lot of it came down to integration, to learning how to do the same thing, the same surrender when I wasn't tripping. And that is more than anything else is how psychedelics have helped me with this.
Wow, there is so much there. Really beautiful. And a lot of it has become actually just extremely central to my life as well. We also run a retreat series ourselves. We've taken people to both Costa Rica for ayahuasca or yaje, and we've done one in the Netherlands with psilocybin. And after seeing nearly 100 people come through this, it is amazing to learn or recognize that almost no matter how severe something is that you're holding on to, it may only take just a few hours of really leaning into it and experiencing it and processing it for it to be very much resolved. And resolved in the sense that, you know, you can make peace with it and it doesn't need to guide you or become a very heavy weight for you to hold. But we are experts. We are ninjas at doing everything we can to avoid ever feeling that stuff. We run from going heads down into our work, into our phones, into entertainment, into literally anything that is not feeling those feelings. And that can stretch on. Like, again, an extreme example might be something like if you had a death of one of your close family members and you didn't want to grieve that, that can stay with you for decades. Some people carry that to their grave. But it may actually take just, and who knows, it could take longer, but like, you know, 3 hours of just deeply weeping and feeling that and feeling that loneliness and that sadness. And you know, at the end, you often come to this place of surrender or acceptance of like, oh, right, they were human. This is part of being human. I'm human. I'm allowed to feel these things. And it doesn't just consume you like it so often can. And you touched on a point that's extremely, extremely important to me now, which is integration. I actually lead up our integration program after the retreats because the way there seems to be this like step process. There's knowing, and that transitions into doing. And then once you're doing, that can transition into being, where it just becomes a part of you. And many of us, some of us are stuck not even at knowing, right? We're ignorant to the things that could be helpful to us. But many of us are stuck at knowing. You know I should take care of my health. I know I should get out. I know I should cultivate friendships. But do you do it? Do you ever actually put in the work to do that? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And it's often because, like, the doing is difficult. It takes a lot of effort. I got to drag my ass to the gym and go lift heavy weights and all that. That's difficult. But if you do it over time, it actually becomes easy. It becomes a part of you. It's like a part of your identity. Like, I'm someone who exercises. And then it feels weird when you don't do it. It's like, whoa, I've missed the gym for a week. Something is off. But you have to get to that, at least to doing, but ideally to being. And the way this all ties back is, you know, your individual experience, the experience you have on psychedelics, they can give you that knowing. They can give you the felt sense of like what is possible. They can like shine a light on a destination. It's like, and that's super valuable. Like if you've been extremely depressed for possibly even all your life, and you suddenly have no, like deep knowledge of what joy feels like, oh my God, that is beautiful. But it does not walk you there. It does not make that the rest of your life. You actually have to go home and then, you know, walk whatever path is needed to get there. And again, that whole section is often not discussed as much as I feel it should be, because they're both like just integral. You can't separate either of them. You need the felt experience and the rewriting of your story and all of that, but you also need to be able to take it back in your home. You know, this is actually, you know, this arguably could have been the case with like the 60s movement, where it was always just chasing the experience and never taking it back home to find the tools that you could use outside of that to reach the same states and to have that same experience.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly put. Absolutely.
And something I was interested in was your comedy ever a useful tool to work through all of this? Like, were you able to kind of process some of your experience by putting it out into your shows or your bits?
I think where it was useful was more in terms of less processing for myself and more. So when I do, you know, when I'm doing stand up, even if it's like, you know, stand up at psychedelic conferences, obviously I can't get too deep into the narrative, because that's not really what it's about. But especially doing the mushroom cure, I think where it helped was more self-acceptance than processing, in the sense of, you know, if I'm up there and I'm talking about experiences that I have a lot of shame around, or had a lot of shame around, or regret, or, and yet there's 100 people or 10 people, you know, whatever it is. But there's a group of people who are receiving it and maybe getting something from it. It kind of is telling myself at some level, like, all right, well, you know what? It's okay. It's okay. If I could share it with other people, you know, I don't have to be so ashamed around it. So I think that helped a lot. Again, as I was saying at sort of the beginning, not so much with the psychedelic use. I never really had shame around that. But around the OCD itself and some of the behaviors that I talk about in the show, that, you know, particularly in regards to sort of the other main person I talk about in the show, aside from myself, was my girlfriend at the time. And there were things I did that were unquestionably selfish and hurtful towards her. And so it's not saying, oh, okay, it's fine that I did those things, but it's, you know, self-acceptance and forgiveness are, I think, crucial for healing. I think, you know, I don't think you can really heal without that. And so, yeah, sharing it with other people, I think, can make it easier for me to forgive and accept myself. And hopefully make it easier for them too, because if they see someone up there talking about stuff, and I get that a lot from audience members, where they'll say, well, you know, hearing you talk about basically, you know, your darkest stuff makes me feel better about my own struggles and challenges and things that maybe I don't feel great about.
Yes, I love this being witnessed or being seen. It's like a counterintuitive truth, because when we're just in our heads, in our own experience, we're like, oh, I have to hide this from everyone because they're going to look at me like an alien and they're going to all judge me. But it's actually one of the best. It's a very valuable tool, because you see that, you know, people actually don't react that differently. They might react more positively, because it's like, wow, thank you for sharing that. Like, I feel like I know you a bit more, and is there anything I can do to help? And it's weird, because it's arguably a major thing that we try to avoid, is owning this and owning our story and being authentic. But at the same time, it's like an incredibly valuable tool that we could use, like getting it out there. And even just the act of like not having it only live in our head can be really helpful. And oh man, and then yeah, your last comment there circles back to almost what we began with of like it's amazing to have people lead and set that example. Like just own the truth and share it, and that gives other people permission. And if we can all do it all becomes normal, and we just keep on moving along. And so I don't want to slip past these, but you had also noted that you've had experiences since the mushroom cure, also some different experiences, and you also noted that it wasn't specifically focused on just processing or working with your OCD. Could you give a bit of info about that? But also, like, why would someone go into these experiences not having like healing that needed to be done, or not having a, yeah, what prompted, or what do you see as the value of continuing to do them?
It's a great question. I think this is a question that, anyone who's going to work with this stuff should be asking themselves. And there's no right answer. I mean, certainly I reject this idea of, oh, you should only be using psychedelics for self-knowledge or healing. I think recreational use is absolutely valid. And I've used psychedelics, specifically and intentionally for that purpose. And I expect to continue to do so. Not that often, but yeah, so for I think one reason also though to use psychedelics is, I believe, and this certainly is not a novel theory for me, McKenna, propounded upon this at length. I think we co-evolved with these plants and fungi. I don't think humans would necessarily be here without them. And so I think we are quote unquote supposed to work with them, not assuming any sort of intelligence dictating that, but just that, yeah, we co-evolve with them. And I think that one of the reasons why it seems things have gone significantly off the rails is our divorce from these plants that, if you look, as best we can tell through the disciplines of anthropology and history, that virtually every society throughout history has had some relationship to, let's call them, visionary plants or psychedelics. And Western society has largely become divorced from that, and I think it's to our detriment. So to put it in simplest terms, I think we evolved at a biological and psychological and spiritual level to work with this stuff. And it's not to say that you can't have a fulfilling life if you don't work with these plants. But I think you're depriving yourself of something that potentially is invaluable and you can't get other elsewhere. So my own view is that, that most people should be working with this stuff, in the right context, in a supportive context. So that's part of why I do it now, is I just feel like, yeah, there's a general benefit that I might not always be able to know beforehand. Beyond that, though, as I said, the OCD is a lot better, but I'm not cured. I certainly still can struggle with anxiety at times, obsessiveness, perfectionism, rigidity, and psychedelics, I find can help with all of that stuff, no question. As well as just getting perspective on my life. There's, my life now, the last time, like I said, I drank ayahuasca was in February. There's different issues I'm confronting in my life right now and different opportunities, and I'm eager to see what perspective I get. Having said that, I may not get any perspective. Ayahuasca for me is, I seem to have somewhat idiosyncratic response. So I've been off SSRIs, these antidepressants, for many years, but it still seems like I don't generally get visions on ayahuasca or any psychedelic. I don't get these sort of, immersive virtual reality type experiences. For me, a lot of the value in the past of ayahuasca has been, in a very concrete way, helping me experience my body more directly and connecting to my body more directly. It's almost a meditative, experience for me. So yeah, I'm going into this experience tomorrow. I don't have a specific intention. I'm not necessarily, I used to be a big believer in, oh yeah, intention is everything. And I don't know, if I look back from my own experiences, my intention is to be open, really, to be open. And my mantra in working with psychedelic for the past 6 months or a year has been relax with everything. And by that, I mean, whatever's coming up, whatever I'm experiencing or seeing or thinking about at a concrete level, continue to try to come back to relaxing my body. That seems to be very helpful guidance for me. So to kind of put a bookend on it, I think there is an infinite number of reasons why someone might choose to work with psychedelics. I think it is helpful to be clear on what your reasons are. So for me, if I wanted to define my reasons for tomorrow, deepen the connection to my body, be open to any perspective or information or insights I might get from going into this state with the aid of this plant. And also, this is a big one for me, is I view psychedelic use as a practice in letting go and surrendering, because I can always go deeper. I can always learn that lesson again and again in different ways. And particularly ayahuasca, I find, can be very helpful in that regard, and mushrooms too.
This was such a fantastic articulation. I have a few comments here. The first is that I've commonly heard the ayahuasca experience as, you know, you get what you need. You get what you need, and because I'm quite similar to you. Most of mine are very embodied experiences. They're not overly visual. And, you know, there is the argument where it's like, well, if you spend way too much time in your head and you're way too, you know, up in mental space, maybe what you need is to come back into your body. And it's like, oh, yeah. And every time that happens, it's like, Jesus, there is some wisdom happening here. It's crazy. And yeah, this is an area that's honestly probably one of the most interesting. It's something I think I'm the most interested in right now. And it might be a little ahead of where the cultural conversation is at, but yes, the intentional, structured, focused use of these experiences for anyone, people who could use healing, or just people who want to continue like growth and development and just see what they're capable of. I think these are indispensable. And you brought up an amazing point on perspective, and I think where some of the value of these experiences come from is that you can almost get this like third person perspective on yourself and look back and just like all the ways where you might have been like easily triggered by something, or you had this like warped thinking that you were just stuck in. You can just like look back at that and be like, what is going on? Where did that come from? I don't want to keep doing that anymore. Or like, I don't enjoy feeling that way. Or like, why do I let that person treat me like that? I wouldn't let anyone else do that. Why? Like, and it becomes just so obvious. Whereas when we're only like in the here and now in our direct first person experience, somehow we miss it or bend reality around it. But to be able to just kind of step back and check yourself in that way is extremely powerful.
Yeah, no, there's, and I think especially for someone who has OCD or, you know, any form of kind of addiction where you are very trapped in your head and getting this perspective. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the realizations I've had on psychedelics have been things that if I told someone else, they would be like, well, duh, of course, I could have told you that. But, you know, you said something earlier when you're talking about kind of that knowing. There's a difference between being like, oh yeah, of course that makes sense, and actually really experiencing it. But yeah, having said that, my experience more recently with psychedelics has been less of that and more just kind of this body connection. And it feels good. Out of like, for me, the last time I drank ayahuasca, I was like, I don't know, it feels like it's something that my being almost craves. I can't put it, it's not even quite clear to me, but it just feels like, oh, I'm doing something. This is a good thing to be doing for myself.
Yeah, really just showing up for yourself, like giving yourself that gift. Wow. Well, this was stunning. This was really stunning, man. Really just the last two things is, so if someone resonated with this, where can they find more about you, more about your work? Is there a place they should check out? And then is there anything you want to leave with? Anything you want to say to the people?
Yeah. I mean, I'm on social media at Atom Strauss, ATOM, like atomic, ATOMSTRAUSS. I have AdamStrauss.com and TheMushroomCure.com. The Mushroom Cure is on hiatus right now, maybe indefinitely. We may be launching, doing some more shows. I'm taking a bit of a break to focus on working on a new show that will hopefully be premiering in San Francisco, this new show, early in 2020. And when I'm, you know, when I'm in New York, which I am for the next few months, I'm generally doing stand-up most nights. So I try to keep the websites current. Beyond that, I don't have any, you know, sage words to leave people with. But I will say, yeah, no, really, really appreciate the conversation and also, yeah, hearing that your own experience. It seems like we do have a lot in common with those experiences, and grateful that we've both been able to find, you know, change and healing through, not exclusively through these medicines, but it sounds like for both of us, this has been an essential part of the puzzle.
Yeah, really well said. Well, yeah, and you know, there are no sage words needed. It's just living your example.
Yeah, which is for all of us, I think, you know. I think we all serve each other by being as truthful, you know, with ourselves as we can, and by living out of that.
Oof. Beautiful. And with that, we will wrap. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you so much for being here for another episode of the High Existence Podcast. If there is someone you think could benefit from hearing this, please take just a second, share it with them, just send them the link so that they can also have access to this. And if you think the message in general is good and worth hearing, you know, a small but mighty step that goes a really long way is leaving a rating on this. It does far more than you think. And so thank you for being here, thank you for being you, and we will catch you in the next episode.